Welcome to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And I'm Steve Hayward. And this week, it's the Originality and Authenticity episode.
We speak with Professor Miles Orvell, author of The Real Thing.
The machine is producing replicas of mostly handmade objects.
Biblical scholar Bart Ehrman tells us about misquoting Jesus.
This book is being copied year after year, decade after decade, by people making mistakes.
We talk about Shakespeare with Murray Ross, the artistic director of theater works.
I mean, maybe the Earl of Oxford had a slightly better chance of writing Shakespeare's plays than a Peruvian transvestite dwarf.
Musicologist Ryan Binyagale takes us through the recorded history of the song You Are My Sunshine.
With all the folk music traditions, there's always going to be different versions, different variants for a song that we might all still call the same song.
And we speak with Thomas Frank, author of The Conquest of Cool, about authenticity, advertising, and the commodification of countercultures.
Counterculture is basically a permanent part of our consumer culture.
This is Off Topic. It's the Originality and Authenticity episode. Stay with us. It was Tuesday last week when Professor Stillman's mother called him on his cell phone. He was at Wooglin's, the deli across the street from the college, and had just ordered. Stillman didn't realize at first that it was his phone because his children had, yet again, changed his ringtone. This was something they did all the time and found hilarious. In the last week, his ringtone had been President Kennedy telling him not to ask what his country could do for him, but what he could do for his country, Donald Duck singing Deck the Halls, an improbably funky song in which the singer insists that every day he's shuffling, and was now a Filet-O-Fish commercial in which a fish pleads with someone to give him that fish.
Give me back that Filet-O-Fish! Give me that fish! Give
me back that Filet-O-Fish! Dude, the waiter told him, I think that's your phone. So, his mother said, you decided to answer. You think I don't know how it works? I know how it works. It's the circle of life. You bring a child into the world, you feed him, you clothe him, you nurture him, you drive him to his soccer games. Later, he sees your name on his cell phone and decides not to pick up. It doesn't work like that, Stillman tried to tell her. Where are you? She asked him. I can hear people. Are you out? I'm having breakfast, he told her. I just ordered. What? She asked. I'm having breakfast, said Stillman more loudly. I just told the waiter my order. I can hear you just fine. I asked what you're having for breakfast. Stillman hesitated for a moment, then said he'd got the melon plate. The melon plate, said his mother. Are you doing the dieting again? You don't say the dieting, Mom, Stillman told her. You just say dieting. Now who's the English professor? I am an English professor, said Stillman, and might have said more had it not been for his order arriving right then. Here you are, Professor Stillman, said the waiter. One authentic. That's what they call the melon plate, said his mother. What kind of breakfast place calls the melon plate the authentic? It was not, in fact, a melon plate. The authentic was a breakfast sandwich which consisted of 3 eggs, 3 slices of bacon, 3 sausages, 3 different kinds of cheese, all of which was sandwiched between 2 halves of a bagel and smothered in green chili.
Oh, yeah.
It was, in other words, exactly the kind of breakfast sandwich his doctor had suggested he not even think about. But ever since that frank conversation with his doctor, the urge to have breakfast at Wooglin's had become irresistible. What did you call me about anyway? Stillman asked his mother, changing the subject. I'm sending you an email, she told him. It's a picture of you. His phone made a little chirp and Stillman opened his mother's email. That's you, she told him. I think you're 6. It was a picture of Stillman. He had on a bright red cape and in his right hand was a long metal pole which he appeared to be lifting up toward a darkening sky. What's that in your hand? His mother asked him. It looks like a lightning rod. It's not a lightning rod, Stillman told her. Don't be ridiculous. What is it then? I don't know, Stillman said. I don't remember any of it. Look how cute you are, his mother told him. You were so cute. Looking at the photograph, Stillman had to admit that yes, in fact, he had been cute. You're still cute, she told him. Don't let anybody tell you any different. And then she hung up. But Stillman kept looking at the picture. Of course he remembered it. It was a lightning rod. He remembered the red cape and the darkening sky. That was the summer his father died, when he made up his mind to become a superhero. He didn't know when or how it would happen, if it would be a radioactive spider or gamma rays, or if he was actually a mutant possessed of unknown and remarkable abilities. The lightning rod was part of it. He didn't know if being hit by lightning would give him superpowers, but it was worth a try. It was something he would think about at night just before going to sleep, the comic book they'd write about it. The Origin of Stillman would be the title. There are times even now when Stillman thought of the empty pages of that unwritten comic book. Maybe it was just a matter of time. Maybe he'd not concentrated hard enough. He decided to try again right there in the Wooglins booth. He closed his eyes and willed himself to burst suddenly, incandescently into flames. But when he opened his eyes, he saw nothing had changed. He lifted the authentic off the plate and took a bite. Most days he was able to resist. Not all of them. This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray, and this week we're discussing authenticity, which is a slippery concept, something that sometimes it's difficult to get our hands around.
And when to put it that way, it reminds me of something that I've actually been thinking about secretly the whole time that we have been interviewing people for this episode. When I was a kid, I really liked drinking Coke. I mean, I wanted Coke more than anything. And my mother knew that if she said the word Coke out loud, that it would result in some kind of... Could I have one? And her code word was, the way she would refer to it when people would come over, she would say, "Would you like a real thing?" Remember the Coke, the
right,
real thing?
It's a real thing. Coke is. That's the way it should be. Coca-Cola.
Could I get you a real thing? She would say to the company. And it would come out, it would look and smell and look every way, just exactly like Coke. And I'd say, "Is that Coke?" My mother would say, "No, that's the real thing."
Right, and everyone knows what that is. Coke, the real thing. And you remember the uproar when there was New Coke.
The New Coke.
Now, you know me, I always loved Coke for years and years. I like this Coke better. The new taste of Coca-Cola.
The New Coke, which was an enormous disaster for the Coca-Cola company because it wasn't the real thing.
Where did this idea come from? Have we always been so obsessed with authenticity?
Well, we spoke to Professor Miles Orville from Temple University, who's the author of a book called, in fact, The Real Thing, which is about this idea of the transformation of American culture. He charts that area at the end of the 19th century to the beginning of the 20th century, where we really see a cultural transformation to valuing authenticity in a way that didn't exist in American culture before that.
The notion of authenticity is one that emerges in the late 19th century, and it's related to a change in attitudes toward the machine, what the machine could do, and how we came to view the machine. So in the 19th century, where I describe a culture of imitation, the machine is producing replicas of mostly handmade objects. And so when people can purchase a whole parlor furniture that looks like it's expensive but is actually, you know, pretty inexpensive, when they can purchase clothing that makes them look like gentlemen, mm-hmm. A whole sort of social problem develops, which is, well, how can we any longer tell the real gentleman from the fake gentleman? And so there's almost a crisis of confidence, and the culture of imitation is fraught with the whole problem of telling the real from the false, telling the, you know, the authentic from the fake.
It seems that there's a lot of anxiety here, class anxiety, that there's this socially fluid world, you know, knowing who the real gentleman is, what the real thing is, only becomes an issue when we have a sort of fluidity or social mobility where we no longer know people's backstories, where we no longer know people's history, where we're stuck in a sense in the world of having to decide the reality of something based on its surface appearance.
Yes, exactly. So this becomes a pervasive problem in social terms, where, you know, we're in a society where people can dress for success, and immigrants coming into this country have to look like Americans. They have to disguise their backgrounds. They have to get rid of their accents. They have to achieve a kind of illusion of being Americans that, in a way, sort of removes the authenticity of their own backgrounds. So in social terms, this becomes a really acute problem for a society that really values social mobility. But it's also, of course, creating opportunities, because if you can look like you want to look, if you can create yourself and invent yourself in a new way, then you have the opportunity to rise in society. So in that sense, the fluidity of American society was to a large degree made possible by the machine, which was able to produce these cheaper goods that could serve as identifying signifiers of social class.
It seems like this is very problematic for American society that has both this desire to get to the real thing, but at the same time, actually a love of the myth of making yourself, the self-made man, where that idea that you would rise in society, that you're not going to be held back by things like your authentic heritage. Is something that Americans seem to have a love-hate relationship with.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There's a real acceptance of this possibility of self-creation, and you know we accept it in our stars, in our celebrities, in our success stories. You know, we love to see this transformation, but we also love to learn about the background, the backstory, you know, where the person came from, what the origins were. So in a way, it's kind of the foundation of the American dream, this notion that you can remake yourself into something new. And it's also been the foundation for a lot of stories of the tragedy of the American dream, because then losing touch with your background produces all of the stress of identity. You know, who am I if I've remade myself, and who am I now?
Thank you so much for being with us. It's just a fascinating discussion.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Professor Miles Orville of Temple University, author of The Real Thing, Imitation and Authenticity in American Culture. This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And Steve, what is at stake about this finding the real thing? What's important about getting to the truth, the authentic, the real?
Well, of course, that's what this is all about, that when we talk about getting to the truth, we talk about getting to an authority about something. What's at stake in the original is authority. And where does that authority come from? How is it defined? What is authorized? This was one of the things that came up in a fascinating discussion that I had with biblical scholar Bart Ehrman, whose research is all about the history of translation and transcription of the Bible. One of the things that his work shows very persuasively is that there's such a complicated process of transmission when it comes to these biblical texts that it becomes nearly impossible to talk about an original, unauthorized, authoritative version of the Bible.
I had been a very strong evangelical, conservative evangelical Christian mm-hmm. from the time I was a junior in high school, and had gone to a very conservative Bible school, Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, and was convinced for years that the Bible was the inerrant, infallible revelation from God, that the very words of the text were given by God. As I went into graduate school and started studying the Bible seriously, when I took Greek to study the New Testament and Hebrew to study the Hebrew Bible, I started realizing that there were so many variations in the manuscripts of the New Testament that we don't have the originals of any of the books of the New Testament. All we have are copies made later, in most cases many hundreds of years later, and all of these copies have differences in them. So we don't have we don't know what the original is in some places. And that threw me for a loop, because if I thought that God had inspired the words of the text, mm-hmm. but we don't have the words of the text. What does it mean? Why would I think in the first place that God had inspired them? He certainly hadn't preserved them because mm-hmm. we didn't have them. So why should I think he inspired them? So this ended up being the kind of discovery that ended up shaking my faith.
So it's not just the remoteness, is that what we have are copies of copies of copies. And that copying has all the instabilities of what happens when you write down anything, right? That's what the fundamental thing is.
So the problem is in the ancient world, there was no way to put a book into production and to distribute it except by having people copy it by hand. And everybody who copies a long text is going to make a mistake. We know the scribes of the New Testament made mistakes because we have thousands of copies, which is great. It's great to have so many copies of the New Testament. But all of these copies are different from one another, so that scribes are changing the text either accidentally or on purpose. And a big problem is that we don't have complete copies of the New Testament for hundreds of years after it was written. So, for example, the Gospel of Mark is probably our first gospel, maybe written around the year 70 CE or so. The first time we have a complete copy of the Gospel of Mark is around 350 or 360.
Wow.
So it's 300 years before we have a complete copy. And between the time Mark was written and the time we have the first copy, this book is being copied year after year, decade after decade, by people making mistakes. And we don't have any of those early copies. So it just shows the problem. It's not a unique problem to the New Testament. I mean, this is just the problem of ancient books in general. But the thing is, most people don't put their faith in ancient books. So if it turns out that Plato is in the same situation, even worse, but people don't base their lives on Plato's very words the way they do in the New Testament.
Right. There's much more at stake when you talk about the gospel truth of something. And one of the things that your book shows, I think, really convincingly is the way in which the whole idea of the gospel is itself has a huge degree of instability.
That's right. This realization that we don't have the original text, we only have later copies, all of which have mistakes in it, opened up to me the possibility that what we're dealing with here is not a divinely inspired and preserved book, but a very human book. Mm-hmm. And once you start seeing the Bible as a very human book rather than an inerrant revelation from God himself, then it completely transforms how you understand the book and how you approach the book and how you think about it.
In what way does it transform it?
Well, if it's a human book, if it's not a divinely given book, of course, one could still say that God speaks through this book, and many people continue to think that. And that's what I thought for many, many years, is that it was a human book, but God spoke through it. But if it's a human book, it would mean that it not only were its copyists human, but also its authors were human. And if the copyists could make mistakes, the authors could make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And you start looking closely at the Bible and you read it carefully, you start finding mistakes. Things have to be mistakes because there are contradictions where one author will say one thing and another author will say the opposite thing, and they both can't be right.
Right.
And so it ends up being a very human book.
And I think that it does show the way in which – I mean, I think that even from a secular point of view, which thinks that, okay, there's going to be interference. I think it's surprising the level of interference, the way the remoteness of anything that is like or even resembles an original in any way.
Well, that's right. And, you know, and again, I want to stress that, you know, I'm not just trying to trash the New Testament here. I'm talking about the realities of the ancient world. So you can say exactly the same thing about Plato. It's worse, much worse for Plato, or much worse for Euripides or Homer, or pick any author you want. This is just the reality we have to deal with ancient books. We don't have originals for anything. We have copies from, centuries or even 1,000 years later, and they have mistakes in them.
So this was something that when you got into it, this intrigued you. What effect did it have on your understanding of what the gospel was then?
Well, it was a kind of chink in my armor. I had been, as I said, a conservative evangelical Christian who thought the very words were inspired by God. And when I realized that we didn't have the words, it made me doubt my doctrine of inspiration of Scripture. And it made me think that, in fact, this book is the logic I had was it just didn't make sense to me anymore to think that God had gone to the trouble of inspiring these authors because why would he inspire the authors if he didn't make sure their words were preserved?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have their words. And so why should I think he inspired them in the first place? So that was my line of thinking. And it led me away from being a conservative Christian who thought that every word was inspired to seeing the Bible as a book which may contain books of religious genius in it, but they may be books that speak to me, but they're not given by God.
What are the wide implications in terms of approaching what happens to the idea of the gospel being a divinely inspired, divinely sanctioned text when we know about all of the things that you talk about in Misquoting Jesus? We know all about these instabilities when we understand the humanness of the gospel text, in a sense.
Scholars have actually had different understandings of the significance of these kinds of data for the view of Scripture. Interestingly, a lot of scholars who work in this field continue to be conservative evangelical Christians who know all of this information. They know about the differences in the manuscripts and the copying practices, and we don't have early ones, and they know all that. And the reason they're interested in this kind of study is because they want to get back to the originals, because they think the originals are inspired. And so they think that human error crept in when scribes were copying it. So they want to get behind the human error back to the divinely inspired original.
Undisputed text.
Yeah. My view is that the fact that there was human error brought into the text should tell us something about the text itself. That not only the text as we've received it was human,
mm-hmm.
but the text as it was produced was human. It's a human text from beginning to end. And so I think that it should be treated that way. It shouldn't be treated as some kind of blueprint handed down by God on high to tell us how we are supposed to live or what we're supposed to believe. And, you know, of course, that's how fundamentalists treat the text, is they treat it as a blueprint for everything, and they appeal to the authority of the text for their own views of things.
Right.
But in fact, they're appealing to their own interpretations of these texts, and they're pointing to texts that we don't even have the originals for. And I think that's problematic.
So in other words, the desire – is this what you're saying? The desire for an original is connected to the desire to use that original as a hammer.
Well, for two things. One is to use it as a hammer in order to enforce one's own point of view. The other is to provide certainty for oneself.
Hmm.
People in our world love certainty. They don't like questions. They don't like ambiguity. They want some certainty. And an inerrant revelation from God gives them certainty. But when you start looking at these manuscripts, you realize just how uncertain the whole thing is. So whether we're comfortable with it or not, we're dealing with a text that we don't even know in places what it originally said.
This is a fascinating discussion. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bart Ehrman, author of Misquoting Jesus. You're listening to Off Topic. Stay with us.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
You know, Steve, one of the sources of authenticity, or one of the places we look for authenticity along with the Bible, is Shakespeare.
Because Shakespeare is so debated about all kinds of things, about which of his works are authentic, what are the authentic versions of his work, even did he even exist? We spoke to Artistic Director of Theater Works, Murray Ross, about this very thing, about the ways in which this search for the real Shakespeare is almost kind of beside the point. What do you make of this whole authorship question, this question of whether there was ever anyone named William Shakespeare? Did he really exist?
Well, yeah, of course he did. You know, I don't have any doubt about that. But, you know, it's fair to say that Shakespeare is such a mysterious phenomenon, you know, someone like Leonardo da Vinci or something like that, that he almost invites continual speculation. I mean, it's partly right because we don't know that much about him. And it's even more, I think, because this body of work that he created is so astonishing that it's hard to imagine anybody doing it.
I'm always persuaded whenever this authorship question comes up. One of the things that convinces me about the questions about Shakespeare authorship and whether he wrote those plays is the existence of the first folio, the first collected works of Shakespeare, which is put together by his contemporaries, the people who work with him in the theater.
Hemings and Cantell, fellow actors in his company 7 years after he died. We know as much about William Shakespeare the man as we do about almost any other Elizabethan playwright. But, you know, there aren't really any other really good candidates for doing this. This is a preposterous leap anyway.
Right.
You know, but I mean, maybe the Earl of Oxford had a slightly better chance of writing Shakespeare's plays than a Peruvian transvestite dwarf, but not much.
One of the things that, being a Shakespearean myself, that my imagination finds its way to is the play Hamlet and thinking about this mysterious Hamlet. And apparently, now if I'm getting this right, Thomas Kidd, the early contemporary of Shakespeare, sort of more of a contemporary of Marlowe, he had, he wrote a Hamlet, which then Shakespeare sort of dusts off and reinvigorates. What do you think about this Hamlet?
I think there probably was one. I think there's enough evidence to suggest that there, whether it was by Kidd or not, might have been by Kidd. He's a good candidate. He's as good a candidate as anybody. But there is a lost Hamlet play, clearly, I think. And one reason we know that is just because not only did Shakespeare write Hamlet from this Hamlet, but John Marston, writing in the same year, also wrote a play very like Hamlet called Antonio's Revenge. Mm-hmm. And they both seem to draw on some of the same common materials that aren't found elsewhere. On the other hand, Hamlet proliferates, doesn't he? I mean, he's all over the place. He goes back to Anglo-Saxon times. He appears in France and, you know, he comes forward in so many multiple ways. But yeah, I think there is a lost play, the Hamlet.
Do you think that the world be richer or a poorer place if we had that Hamlet?
Oh, yeah, I would love to have it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I'd love to have it. Come across that lodestone, that little... Yeah, absolutely. Would it make Hamlet a better play, you know, the one that we have? I don't think so.
No.
But it would be fantastic. And, of course, we'd want to do it.
It's interesting that we have this idea, it's a romantic idea of Shakespeare, as being this artist among the preeminent writer in the English language, arguably the preeminent writer who's ever lived.
In any language.
And we have this idea of Shakespeare as being the first, or the original in some kind of way, the authentic genius. And yet these stories, Hamlet, all of the stories, except for perhaps parts of The Tempest, clearly come from somewhere else.
Yeah, he borrowed them all.
What does that tell us about the idea of originality, of authenticity, the fact that we have this figure, this towering figure at the center of our Western conception of genius and of creativity, very clearly more of a modifier of text rather than a creator of them?
Well, I would say he's a transformer of text, not just a modifier. I think you slipped that one in. But certainly he's a magpie. He pulls from everything in the known world. I think he pulls from nature, from stories, and he's a writing guy. You know, he's picking up what's hot. He's picking up what other people are reading. He's working with it, and then he completely transforms it and makes it into something entirely new. I mean, come on, you look at Hamlet and you look at all the source materials for Hamlet, and it's a completely different, I mean, they're relationships, but it's a whole new world. It's a whole new galaxy when you get there. And I think that's always true of Shakespeare. Everyone else is really way, way behind. You know, Tolstoy, Flaubert.
Well, I mean maybe
else?
Way behind.
Way behind? Well, pretty far behind.
Like Dante? Even in the rearview mirror?
Many miles down the road, little dust pack, you know, come on.
So, you know, Chaucer in the receding into the sunset.
Way. Lost him in New England. Yeah. It's just phenomenal how dominant Shakespeare is.
One of the ways in which Shakespeare is often talked about is being not just the authentic theater practitioner, the authentic author, but the authentically human person.
That's true.
Who invents the human?
Yeah, Harold Bloom.
Harold Bloom's famous phrase.
Shakespeare invents the human. Yeah. Well, surely that's not true. I mean, Odysseus seems extremely human to me.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. You know, a lot of characters in Chaucer seem, in Boccaccio. They may be, but they're very human. They're very recognizable. Surely Shakespeare is not inventing the human. But certainly to this level of introspection and contradiction and multi-layered kinds of personality, Shakespeare seems to have contributed to that more than anybody else, don't you think?
Well, you think about moments like in Hamlet, there's the rub. And then something happens on stage in which you see displayed on stage a kind of interiority, a moment of thought where you see some kind of subjectivity, some kind of person.
Yeah, it does have something to do with this feeling of interiority. I mean, Hamlet says, "You can't pluck out my mystery."
Mm-hmm.
And surely he's right about that. I mean, we've been after it for a long time, and we get little bits and pieces, but we'll never get it. You know, we'll never be able to reach in and say, aha, gotcha, solved you, Hamlet. You're totally done. And I think there is something that's true about human beings. I mean, there's always something kind of incomplete or unfinished or ungraspable about real people that we know.
Marie Ross, Artistic Director of TheatreWorks, thank you so much.
Pastime with good company I love and shall until
this is off topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. You know, we talk about the authenticity of literature, but there's all sorts of things around us where we're looking for the original, the true, the authoritative version of
something. Yeah, we're not looking for it. You think about a song like You Are My Sunshine. You know the song You Are My Sunshine?
Absolutely. Do you want me to sing it now?
No, thank you. Who wrote it?
I don't know.
Me neither.
And when did you learn it? When did you learn it? Or have you feel like you've always known
I've always known it. I feel like You Are My Sunshine is one of those songs. It's up there in the ether, that it just exists in some kind of independent way, right? Like it comes from the folk. Who wrote it? It's kind of a ridiculous question to ask. Who wrote You Are My Sunshine? Who owns the copyright of You Are My Sunshine?
Because it belongs to us all.
Because it belongs to us. The fact is, You Are My Sunshine does not belong to us all. That You Are My Sunshine is a copyrighted text. Musicologist Ryan Benigale tells a really interesting story about this song and how it came to seem to be the kind of cultural product that has no authoritative version. Owns the copyright of You Are My Sunshine?
The copyright of You Are My Sunshine belongs to Jimmy Davis.
Jimmy Davis, Governor Jimmy Davis.
Governor Jimmy Davis of Louisiana.
All right, so tell us a little bit about Jimmy Davis and that circumstance of how he records it.
Yeah, Jimmy Davis recorded it back in 1940. And Jimmy Davis's recording was marketed kind of towards the what we think of today as the country market.
Yeah.
Back then it was called the hillbilly market. And he recorded it in 1940. Along with just a group of studio musicians. But the way that he told the story later on in life, it's got kind of a much more interesting history.
It was with three other country musicians quite a few years ago. We were barnstorming the country, trying to make a little dough. We made all the chili joints, eating hot dogs and stews. And at nighttime, three deep and a four-bit bed, all singing the hard time blues. Hoping someday we'd record a hit and things would be sweet. Then we'd settle down on that place you call Easy Street. It so happened on 1 July the 6th, we recorded a little ditty. It went something like this.
So, July 6th, they record a little ditty. It goes like this. Is that the true story?
Well, actually, it wasn't July the 6th. It was February 5th. And he recorded it with six musicians, not the three that he mentions there. And it was recorded in New York City.
Wow. So what do you attribute this fictionalization of the origin of You Are My Sunshine to?
Well, it's got a lot to do with his legacy as the governor of a southern state
yeah.
and having this close connection to the people. You Are My Sunshine became the state song for Louisiana. And so it's always been associated with him. And, you know, we want to have stories that go along with what we have as our vision of our past. And I think that this introduction really, really provides a sense of what he would like us to know about him and the song.
The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping, I dreamed I held you in my arms.
So that's Jimmy Davis. All right, so then a year later, Bing Crosby records it.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
One thing about this particular recording that's interesting is just how organized the arrangement is. If you compare it to the Jimmy Davis recording,
right,
with Bing Crosby, we have strings and woodwinds, and it's clearly studio musicians sitting in front of written out notes playing a prepared piece. The musicians that we hear on the Jimmy Davis recording is a little bit more spontaneous.
Yeah, there's a lot of improvisation, a lot of soloing, and it's gone here. It becomes a sort of a very, well, to me, very sort of sanitized official version of the song.
Sure, it's certainly one that's marketed or put together to be marketed to the masses.
Let's move on to a later version of You Are My Sunshine, one that's recorded by the great Ray Charles.
Absolutely.
Oh, you are my sunshine.
You are my sunshine.
Oh, my only sunshine.
This is a big change.
Right. What we have here is we have the Raylettes. Ray Charles is backing ensemble of women. And it provides a sense that there's a conversation perhaps happening here, as opposed to just one person delivering the song.
Yeah, and that, and then the way in which the song becomes a dialogue, that's one of the innovations Ray Charles brings into it. He also makes it a little bit more of a bluesy song. Though certainly the song has the structure of the blues to begin with, right?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that, you know, thinking back to Jimmy Davis's recording, his recording locked in place a lot of moments or aspects of music composition that individual performers could subsequently pick up on and highlight. And that's something that Ray Charles's recording really, really emphasizes.
All right, so let's ask the question about where did Jimmy Davis get it from? Is it true that Jimmy Davis, the guy who owns the copyright, is it true that he wrote it?
It is not true that he wrote it. What he really did was he ended up purchasing the song, and then he had a hit. So Jimmy Davis acquired the song You Are My Sunshine from a group called the Rice Brothers Gang.
It's interesting when you put that next to the Jimmy Davis version. Jimmy Davis sounds really slick, whereas before he sounded very not produced.
Right, and now when we put it in the context of this recording by the Rice Brothers Gang, which was made about 7 months before Jimmy Davis made his, it's a completely different sound.
All right, so they wrote it then. The Rice Brothers that's the origin of You Are My Sunshine, right?
The Rice Brothers would like us to think they wrote You Are My Sunshine, but the story goes back even further.
All right, so who did they get it from?
The most direct connection that I've been able to find has been through the recordings that have been left behind by some of these other artists, and particularly probably one of the best-known country recording groups of all time, which is the Carter Family. And they recorded a song called Little Darling Pal of Mine, which if you just listen, say the title, Little Darling Pal of Mine.
Sounds a lot like
You Are My Sunshine. Melodically, it's not exactly the same melody line as You Are My Sunshine, but it's very close. What's more important to listen for is the lyrics.
All right, so is there a particular member of the Carter family who wrote this then? These immortal lyrics?
To the best of my knowledge, there's not a particular person in the Carter family that wrote these lyrics. The lyrics from this actually might come from an earlier song.
An earlier song. Now, who's the song?
The earlier song, Even Still, is a piece by a blues guitar vocalist named Blind Willie Davis, and a song called Rock of Ages.
My loving mother, when there was on fire, don't you want God for some, so be your pillow, for hide me over, and the rocks of ages. Rocks of ages.
When you look back on these, on the recorded genealogy of You Are My Sunshine, does it make sense to talk about an original version of the song?
You know, I don't think it makes, I don't think we need to talk about it in terms of original, because with all the folk music traditions, there's always going to be different versions, different variants of the tunes and of the melodies and of the lyrics that we get for a song that we might all still call the same song.
When you think about this, about folk music, when you think about a song like You Are My Sunshine, I guess the question I want to ask you is, if it doesn't make any sense to really talk about an original of You Are My Sunshine, does it make sense to talk about an original of any song? Because doesn't every other song sound like the song that came before it is in some way, or does it just simply hinge on whether the lyrics are the same?
Well, one thing about You Are My Sunshine that I think separates it from the way we think about the composition of music today is that because it did develop in such an amorphous way, it doesn't make sense to think of an original of You Are My Sunshine. Now, you take a song off of the radio today, like a pop song on the top of the charts, it was created and constructed very specifically by 1, 2, maybe 10 people,
yeah,
sitting in a production studio, really piecing it together and making that piece. Now, we could say that whatever they create and put on the album is the original. We might say the first take is the original, and what we get maybe 3 or 4 takes later that's released is not the original, but really a copy of it, even though that's the one that gets distributed.
I see. And that's the irony of You Are My Sunshine, is that on the one hand, you have it very strongly associated with Jimmy Davis, very firmly policed copyright borders of You Are My Sunshine, of a song that is, in essence, everywhere else but there.
Tell me why do you believe?
Because
you're listening to Off Topic. Stay with us.
But when I woke up and found out I was mistaken, yeah, you know that I hung my head,
you know that I
hung my head and I cried.
Head and I cried.
Baby, 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 you are sunshine.
Baby,
yes, you make me happy, baby. Oh, when the sky.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And, you know, when we think about what it means to be authentic as a person, we often think about defying conformity, finding a unique voice,
yeah,
our own vision, and really following that.
Is what you're referring to the bright red jeans that I bought last summer in Italy? Is that kind of what you mean?
That's the authentic Steve.
We've all had those moments when we're abroad. It often happens in Italy as one of the main places that you see some bright red jeans on another person. You think, that's me.
But is it that you see it on another person or that you have your own vision? How much of our ability to be our unique selves is about defying what other people are doing? And how is that even possible? Could you buy the red jeans if you didn't see them on at least one other person? Is there some way that we can have cultures,
yeah,
subcultures, countercultures?
No part of my authentic self is about defying anyone, I think. You know, I'm incredible. I embrace conformity.
We talked to Thomas Frank, the author of The Conquest of Cool. He's also the co-founder and editor of The Baffler, a regular columnist with Harper's and The Nation, and most recently author of What's the Matter with Kansas, about the connection between authenticity, advertising, countercultures, and the political life of the United States. When we think about the idea of a counterculture, we often think about a really fragile authenticity that is at risk for being co-opted by commercialism and consumerism. But you argue in The Conquest of Cool that that really isn't the case. That's not really what goes on with these countercultures.
Yeah, that's right. The counterculture as a reaction to mass society, you know, as this adversarial thing is not really, I think, an accurate way of understanding what happened then or what's happening now. I mean, ever since the 60s, we've had, this model, this countercultural model. We've just had one after another after another after another. And I think what's clear, after all these years is that counterculture is basically a permanent part of our consumer culture.
How so? What do you mean by that?
I mean that it's not that advertising that the advertising industry co-opts counterculture, and it's not that the advertising industry invents counterculture, but that the two are that they live in a sort of symbiotic relationship one to the other.
So this is the thing, that the counterculture wasn't necessarily this pure thing that got used, but was also drawing from, in many ways, the advertising culture preceded some of the countercultural ideas.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, the basic sort of countercultural idea, which is this critique of conformity, this is something that had been around in the sort of broader commercial culture, or well, whatever, however you want to call it, the broader culture of America for a long time before the counterculture came along. In the 1950s, there was this whole literature about conformity and the problem of the mass society and regimentation and a society that was bound by too many rules and that was overly scientific and was drowning out the individual and all this kind of thing. This was the standard criticism of advertising and of the corporate world generally in the 1950s and on up into the 1960s, and it still is today. And what's fascinating to me is that advertising came up with all of these different ways of sort of addressing that problem and, encouraging people to, defy the regimented society and the scientific-driven mentality and blah, blah, blah through consuming. And they still do this today. And counterculture came along a little bit later and just sort of provided a perfect language for describing this sort of appeal.
Right. So I'm looking at in The Conquest of Cool, I'm looking at some of the ads that you've included. And one is an ad for Booth Gym from 1965 says at the top of the page, it says, "I hate conformity." And then it's selling gin.
That's right. And gin, you got to remember this now. Gin was the conformist drink. This was
right.
This is the main ingredient in a martini, we don't remember now because we've been through so many different cycles of hipness and cycles of authenticity that the counterculture was, reacting against what was called the three martini lunch. This was something that was supposed to be really awful. What's funny is, of course, the martini has been revived since
right.
then, not once, but twice.
As a sign of hipness.
Exactly. So you could actually say now that ad, there's something kind of genius about it, because people really do think that a martini now is the drink of a nonconformist or something.
So tell me about that. What is that cycle that happens, this sort of cyclical relationship between hipness co-optation or hipness consumerism? How do those two things work in concert with each other?
Advertising, like I said, really embraced this critique of the mass society. And it decided what advertising sells us is not just a product, but a whole way of looking at the world. And this way of looking at the world incorporates a certain critique of capitalism. And that critique of capitalism says, yeah, capitalism, they want everybody to fit in and everybody to be a number, but, by golly, you're yourself.
Whether a meatball marinara with jalapenos or a low-fat sweet onion chicken teriyaki with banana peppers, you can always be yourself at Subway.
So the two, it's made hipness into this kind of perma-critique. this sort of a permanent counterculture that never goes away. And advertising encourages it. But there's all sorts of other ways of criticizing capitalism that advertising doesn't talk about. It settles on this one critique of capitalism that's always about conformity and about horrible mass-produced plastic stuff that you want to resist by buying stuff that's authentic, by buying stuff that's real and down to earth.
Lots of companies are taking high fructose corn syrup out of their foods now. Before that, it was trans fats, and before that, artificial sweeteners. But at Kashi, we've kept our foods real from the start.
And this has been going on since the 1960s, and it goes on in cycle after cycle after cycle. You know, one cycle rebelling against the previous cycle. This happens all the time.
Right. And so I noticed, that you have in the last chapter of your book, you talk about retro. And
yes, that was hot back then. You got to remember, this book was written in the 1990s.
Right. But retro's back again.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was just reading the other day that Levi's 501 jeans now are on all the runways of the spring fashion collections because it's getting back to the authenticity of Levi's 501 jeans.
Authentic. It's a pair of jeans.
Yeah, yeah, and that was big when I was in high school in the 1980s as a kind of throwback to the 1950s as a rebellion against the bell bottoms, you know. Or one of my favorites is the different cycles of 50s nostalgia. We've been through so many. You think of Happy Days in the 1970s. You think of all of these different versions of it. My kids just watched what's that movie? Back to the Future. Which has its own sort of 1950s nostalgia. And, and so there's these different sort of grades and levels of 50s nostalgia. And my favorite sort of fact about 50s nostalgia is that Sha-na-na, you remember them? The,
yes.
The sort of fake doo-wop band? They played at Woodstock. And then, of course, you have nostalgia for Woodstock. I mean, there's an endless nostalgia for Woodstock. You know, pretty soon we're going to come up on the 50th anniversary of it here.
Right, and it keeps coming back. And it seems like also there is an acceleration of this cycle, that things get recycled more and more quickly all the time.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. But I have to say, I don't follow this stuff anymore. I don't know if you know about this, but I took up political writing at some point.
Yes,
and I stopped writing about consumer culture.
And so this is the thing that you're saying, that in some ways you don't write about culture anymore because you're writing books like What's the Matter with Kansas, and you're really becoming a political writer. But well, I want to talk about Joe Biden, actually.
Joe Biden.
About a year ago, he said, the television show Will and Grace did more to advance gay rights in the United States than anything else, really arguing that these cultural changes do have a political impact. And I was wondering, do you think that that's correct? Is he right? Or is this just the sort of revolution in consciousness that really isn't doing anything in practical terms?
Ooh, that's a tough one, because on the one hand, I'm pretty liberal and I support something like, gay marriage. I don't want to say that's a big nothing, but there's two things that are interesting about that statement. One is that the idea that social change is driven by TV rather than the other way around. And this is something that academics, argue about all the time, but basically nobody in academia makes that claim that social change is driven by television. But I think there is probably something to it. I think that he might be right. I mean, we hear so much these days about the democratization of the mass media, the internet. And yet at the same time, it still feels like, to me anyways, like culture is something made by other people. And I say that as someone who was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, is currently a columnist for Harper's Magazine. I mean, I've gone about as far as you can go in the world of journalism. And I still feel like all of these, cultural changes, political debates, these are things that are held by other people. And I still feel that way, even though I am so damn empowered by the internet and everything.
Right. See, that's interesting because I feel that way about politics, actually.
Yeah. Well, no, the same. You know, we're constantly told that we live in this intensely democratic age. You know, the politicians have to listen to us and the TV producers have to listen to us. And everybody has to listen to us because we're so empowered because we all own stock or we can all type something into the internet and we all have email. And yet it feels to me like the debate is more narrow now than it ever was. I mean, you think of – look back at the period that I describe in The Conquest of Cool in the 50s and the 60s when you didn't have the internet. And there really were only three networks, and there were only a few magazines in this country that mattered, you know, Life and Look, and Time, maybe. There were so many more political choices on the table back then than there are today. I mean, for God's sakes, they were going to pass, what was the Humphrey-Hawkins law, which was going to mandate a guaranteed national income or something like that. I mean, there are all sorts of things that were being debated then that are just completely unthinkable today. And yet we have this elaborate illusion of choice.
And is that something, though, exactly about what we're talking about this co-optation, so that we have the illusion of choice? We're sitting home and we're voting for the next American Idol.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, at the same time, there are political choices that are not available to us, political choices that were available to our parents and our grandparents that are not available to us, that are off the table, is the expression that they use.
I'm thinking about this idea that the 50s was so stultified is really a myth. You know, it was in 1955 that Rosa Parks did not give up her seat on the bus, that this political action was happening then. And it seemed that there was perhaps even more political action happening before there was as much media attention to it, that there was because of the co-optation of these political movements, they became more theater and less action.
And there's all sorts of reasons for that, but one of them is that, and this is again via the counterculture, dissent became a lifestyle thing rather than an economic thing. And that's an enormous change, and it still is that way today. You know, that we think we are rebelling via the clothes that we wear, and it also there's a class change here. The counterculture, it used to be criticized for being largely upper middle class, and I think that was sociologically speaking true, that it was that. And so a funny thing happened in that this kind of upper middle class bohemianism it replaced this sort of older tradition of what dissent was, sort of older tradition that always identified dissent with, workers, Well, I'm talking about, thinking about populism, thinking about the 1930s here. And we've just been through another, we're still in a sort of depression, but we've just gone through this terrible recession. And it's not a surprise to me that the country was not able to sort of to think in the manner of the 1930s, that it wasn't able to sort of follow through on the things that our grandparents did in the 1930s, where you had this sort of political revolution in this country.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been fascinating.
Sure, anytime.
Express yourself.
So what do you think, to come back to where we started? What about the question of the real thing? Is there a real thing? Should we want it so badly?
Why do we want the real thing? And I think even more importantly, what do we use this concept of the real for? Can the searching for the real be, for example, a weapon in a political battle or something where we're looking for real political change?
I think it's often the case that when people want the authentic, when people want the real, what they really are asking for is a hammer. Ultimately, then, the question shouldn't be so much, how do you define the real? Or how is the authentic constituted? But what does the real mean?
And how do you use it? Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell, with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
You can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. If you play a-